That's not very Marxist of you.
From Topic Studios and WarnerMedia Podcast Network, this is Politically Reactive. I'm Debbie Kamau Bell.
And I'm professional baby spit-up rag, Hari Kondabolu.
Once again, we're two friends and stand-up comics and dads trying to make sense of American politics.
But we don't restrict ourselves just to American politics. There's a lot going on in the world, and we're going to be covering it this week.
Oh, that was very NPR of you.
Oh, thanks.
Last week, we talked about the historic farmers' protest in India.
And this week, we talked to someone who brings a radical perspective to what's happening in India today. Historian, journalist, one of my all-time heroes, Vijay Prashad.
You know, we need to produce healthy food close to where people live. That's the system I want to live in. And that system is simply not profitable.
Vijay talks about the importance of international solidarity and why people in the United States should care about farmers in India, and also why people in the United States should care about farmers in the United States.
Articulate your solidarity with the farmers of India, but make sure it's not just about India. You show your love to the farmers by showing your love also to yourself.
In his latest book, Washington Bullets, Vijay Prashad writes about the CIA's suppression of dissent and people's revolutions around the world. Also, during this podcast, he talks some shit about Dinesh D'Souza, and it's lovely.
And in the second part of the show, we'll talk about the violent suppression of dissent at home. The FBI-backed assassination of Black Panther leader Fred Hampton.
What Hampton's story is like, when you hear it for the first time, it just overwhelms you. Hampton was only 21, and he did so much at a young age, and you can't help but think, like, what would he have become if he wasn't murdered by the state?
It's the story told in the new movie Judas and the Black Messiah. Our guests Keith and Kenny Lucas have wanted to tell this story a long time, well before they became known as the twin brother comic duo, the Lucas Brothers.
Which isn't to say they're giving up on stand-up.
So comedy's over now?
No, absolutely not.
It's all coming up on Politically Reactive.
That's my line. It's literally my line. It says my name. It says Kamau. I say that part every week.
I just wanted to mix it up. Hey, Kamau.
Hey, Hari.
Well, Donald Trump was acquitted, so the temperature in hell remains the same. Not shocking. We all knew this was going to happen. He's free.
I mean, it's funny when all the senators were voting and I was watching like the live vote tally. There's a moment where like the votes to find him guilty were ahead, and I had a brief moment of like, oh, it's gonna happen, like super brief.
Yeah, but then you know, the reality of the situation caught up with that, and we're even worse off as a country as a result. I mean, I'm glad he's gone, but the idea that the threat of him running is even still in the air is horrifying.
As I watched the whole thing going on, I was like, I don't know who needs to hear this, but this whole impeachment is really just a referendum on whether white supremacy should continue to be the organizing principle of the United States of America. And turns out it's going to.
Yeah.
It's going to continue. Yeah. 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 It's just business as usual. No, I mean, I enjoyed meeting new people like Joe Neguse. I think that's how you pronounce his name. It's a very awkward name for a black man to have. I enjoyed hearing from Jamie Raskin and Stacey Plaskett, who quoted Run the Jewels as part of her speech. So, yeah, but last week on the show, we talked to Adam Gentleson and the idea about, like, you know, sometimes you get graded for effort in democracy.
Yeah.
And, no disrespect to the people who did that work. I don't know if we got an A for effort in this one. I think we got maybe a B-ish, B-minus. The effort was there. There's a point they talked about calling witnesses, and I was like, oh, here we go. And I get that they wouldn't have changed any of the votes of those Republicans, but it might have changed America's minds more if we saw witness after witness talk about all the things he had done to bring the attack.
Like, I think America, who's paying attention to the same news sources we are probably like, yeah, we know what he did. He's clearly guilty. Mm-hmm. And yet the Republicans are not going to find him guilty. I don't think there was anything they were going to, there was nothing that could be said to turn 10 more people to conviction. So, I mean, what is the point? It's theater at that point, right?
But theater counts, and I think you would have loved to have seen, I would have loved to have seen the QAnon shaman out of his makeup, like when you finally saw members of KISS without their makeup on. I would have loved to have seen the QAnon shaman turn state's evidence against Trump. I would love to have seen some of those people who we have footage of them like, who did not get pardoned, who Trump has not talked to at all since then, to see them go, yeah, he's the guy who called me here. I came here for him, and now he won't return my calls or my parlor tweets or whatever it is. That's why I think it would have been nice to see for it to go on longer. I just think for America to really see how a lot of us think we're paying attention, or a lot of people think they're paying attention to it, but to see it play out sort of slowly and methodically, I think would have helped, would have put Trump further on the back foot than he already is. Because, like, I've heard that Trump feels like he's been vindicated, and he's like, and then you've heard he feels like he's the future of the party. And, you know, and then I think the worst moment of this, which is why I would have liked it to go on longer, was your boy, Mitch McConnell. Your boy, Mitch McConnell.
I'm not from Kentucky. I am not a Republican. Because I wear glasses? Is that what this... You
yep,
wear glasses.
There you go. Yeah. After he voted to acquit Trump, then decided to give up and give his fiery end of Mississippi burning speech.
He definitely did it, but...
Yeah, decided to give the speech that indicted Trump, but he didn't want to actually do the work of indicting him. And the speech where he goes, I would love to have voted to find him guilty, but unfortunately we should have done this when he was still president. Mitch, you were the one who decided not to call the Senate back from recess. That was you. You're saying you wish you had done something different.
You also had two chances to impeach him before this happened.
Yeah, I can't help but feel like it's a sad day because just like again, Trump's out there running amok. It's thinking like he won, and all we can hope for, to quote Ashur Rangappa, is the OJ in Florida part happening.
Oh, right. That he's eventually going to fuck up again, and this time people will be on him.
He's got 4 years to do that before it's time to talk about running for president again.
Imagine after all this, we find out that Trump is actually a lizard person and not like Hillary Clinton, like QAnon says. Imagine, nobody would expect that. Like, what? They were right about the lizard person part, but it was the wrong person.
The QAnon thing is not dead. Parler is back up some. Apparently, Parler has found a new place to host their site. And apparently, March 4th is a new date that is popping up on the QAnon channels. March 4th. So there's more to come, everybody.
The FBI will get a hold of that date after whatever happens. Then they'll go back. And I mean, that's the thing. A lot of this is widely available. It wasn't like you needed, like, we're going to talk about this a little later, but you didn't need informants and stuff to figure this shit out, right? Like, this, they're writing, like, we are going to do this on this day with this many people.
Yeah. You're right. It does connect to what we're here talking about the show. You bring up the FBI. There's a lot of FBI talk in this show. And a lot of talk of the system sort of being set up against the black, brown, indigenous folks that live in this world, actually, like, as we're going to talk about later.
And we're not the only pair of comedians that is talking about it on this particular episode, which is amazing, because I didn't know there were more of us.
yes.
But the Lucas brothers come on, and they helped, you know, co-create this incredible movie, Judas and the Black Messiah. And, you know, it's when I first heard, you know, this was made in part with the Lucas brothers, I'm like, oh, there's another set of Lucas brothers? Oh, that's crazy. There's another.
Yeah.
And there's the ones that do comedy and the other. And it's like, it's the same guys. It's not that I sold them short. It's that I sold all comedians short. I just did not expect this masterpiece would come from a comedian or a pair of comedians.
You did the same thing to them that people do to us. What are those guys doing over here?
Right. Like, oh, comedian self-hate. I mean, there's a complex there.
But before we get to the Lucas brothers, we have a very special guest that you're excited about on the show, Indian historian and journalist Vijay Prashad. We're going to talk to him about the farmers' protests in India, but also about whatever he wants to talk about.
He knows about a lot of stuff, and from this interview, you will see moments where, like, where is he going with this? Has he forgotten what this interview is about? And then all of a sudden, oh, there you go.
Yeah, he's got the confidence of a tenured professor. Like, I'm going to start here, and I got it all here, but you're going to wait till I get there. It's I get to take my time because I'm not afraid of being fired.
So enjoy this episode of Politically Reactive.
Oh.
Last week on the show, we talked about the farmers' protests in India. We gave you some basic information about what's at stake and how we can show solidarity. Again, you can go to the website farmersprotest.carrd.co. farmersprotest.carrd.co.
But we want to give you more detail and more context. So we reached out to historian, journalist, and one of my all-time heroes, Vijay Prashad. You know, he pretty much can talk about anything. And obviously, this was something that's right in his wheelhouse. So we had to get Vijay on, and I'm super excited about this particular episode.
And Vijay Prashad's latest book is Washington Bullets, A History of the CIA, Coups, and Assassinations.
Well, that's going to confuse some basketball fans, I think.
I don't know. I think that describes the Washington Wizards franchise, too.
Right. Yeah, that's... Let's talk to Vijay. Brother Vijay, it is so good to have you on our show. Thank you for joining us. This is my friend, Kamau.
It's great to be with you. It's nice to meet you, Kamau.
Kamau, to give you some context of Vijay's importance to me and I think a generation of South Asian organizers and activists, his book, The Karma of Brown Folk, which in some ways is a sequel to The Souls of Black Folk by Du Bois. I wouldn't say necessarily, maybe to some people were radicalized by it. A lot of people were forced to think about their world, their role as Asian Americans in the U.S. differently, how we're used as a weapon against Black people as part of the model minority stereotype. It's like he's W.E.B. Du Bois, and Dinesh D'Souza is Booker T. Washington. And that's insulting Booker T. Washington, and I'm sorry about that. Like, wow.
At least Booker T. started a school.
and there's...
Dinesh was the president of a university.
He was?
Yes. Oh, that's right, he was. That's right, he was, yeah.
Mm. I feel like Vijay doesn't get credit for the early Dinesh D'Souza bashing he did in The Karma of Brown Folk. He was an originator of the form.
I'm not sure if that's a compliment, but I must say that I once debated him in the 1990s, and somebody asked him a question about affirmative action, which is, you know, a fair question at that period. And he said, if I'm eating a sandwich, why should I break my sandwich into two and hand half the sandwich to somebody else? That was his argument against affirmative action. So, you know, I cut in with the obvious thing and said, Dinesh, that's not the issue. The issue is there's a tray. You have 100 sandwiches and somebody else has maybe one, if not, you know, maybe they have none. And so we're going to just take about 85 of your sandwiches and hand them around. That's actually how the sandwich thing works. And you're so angry with me.
For those of our listeners who aren't followers of Dinesh D'Souza, and I don't follow him, but I'm aware, how would you describe him to what is his role in this current in the world currently?
Well, his role, just quickly, and I don't know why I remember this or want to talk about him, but it began at Dartmouth College, where he was a hard right activist, spewing racism in the name of justice, which is really the worst part of these people. He wrote a book called End of Racism, where he argued essentially that there's no such thing as racism in the present moment. This was in 1995. You know, to talk like that at a time when in the 1990s, police brutality had begun to escalate. This is, you know, shortly after the incidents in Los Angeles with the Rodney King beating initially, and then the uprising in Los Angeles. To talk like that then and to continue to talk like that through, you know, American history is punctuated with violence against Black people. That's basically a definition. If you ask me for a one-sentence definition of American history, I would say it's punctuated by violence, violent episodes. And it's not Black people in general. It's a class attack. I mean, what is the issue here with somebody in New York City allegedly selling loose cigarettes? Mm. Is that a reason to be killed? You know, this is a working class man trying to make a living. Or in another city in the United States, a person allegedly having passed a $20 bill. You know, what is that but a working class Black man trying to make a living? if the allegation is true, we don't even know if it's true. That's what he was killed for. And I'm talking there about George Floyd. And, you know, in this context, to talk about race in such a shallow way, you know, to talk about it in this way, it's an abomination. You know, it really is something quite terrible. And that's the figure of Dinesh D'Souza. He's not alone. I mean, there's a tribe of them that perform this business for the people of business. Their role is to undermine the suffering and sorrow that comes off the streets of the United States of America, which today goes by the name of Black Lives Matter. In an earlier generation, went by the name of the Black Panther Party of Self-Defense and so on.
This is just Vijay warming up, Kamau. He's just getting warm. We haven't even gotten to the farmers' protest yet.
This is like just like a baseball player swinging two bats around, just sort of loosening up right now.
The other day I was on a radio program and the person said, calm down, you'll have a heart attack. And I said, you have no idea. I mean, we're talking about things. How can you ask me to calm down? I mean, these are things about the most sensitive parts of human life, right? A murder of people on the streets, the farmers' movement. I mean, what does calm down even mean?
I agree.
Calm down is another way of saying shut up, but politely. Speaking of the farmers' protest, what is happening in India right now?
Well, first, three cheers to Rihanna. Three cheers to Greta Thunberg. Three cheers to Mia Khalifa. You know, for these three women to come out there on Twitter and support something happening half a world away is quite admirable, in my opinion. I have to say that as we speak, a young 21-year-old young woman who's part of the movement that Greta Thunberg has moved is under arrest for making a toolkit to help understand the farmers' movement. I mean, this is the state of where India is. Agriculture in a capitalist system has a hard time being profitable, which is why most governments subsidize agriculturalists. In the European Union, they spend $65 billion a year to subsidize agriculture. And farmers just can't make a living in this kind of system because this system is against agriculture, you know, where it's hard to turn a profit, you know, in a quarter. It's hard to do that. You have to borrow money. The more money you borrow, you're under stress to pay it back when the harvest comes in. And, you know, nature is cruel. Sometimes the harvest betrays you and you can't do it. And then you go into debt. And agriculture is a hard time. Therefore, governments underwrite agriculture. In India, since the Indian Republic was formed in 1950, the spending by the state to both have a price support system, in other words, the government comes in, buys agricultural produce to stabilize prices, and to buy agricultural produce to put into public distribution to prevent hunger. You know, you're both helping farmers and helping the hungry. That's what the whole social democratic system of Indian agriculture was about. Last year, in September, during this pandemic, the extreme right-wing government in India decided that they wanted to basically break down this social democratic consensus and decided to hand over the marketplace to big corporate entities, particularly cronies of this extreme right government, the families of Ambanis, the families of Adanis, and so on. They had been buying up grain silos, for instance, before this law was pushed through parliament. Immediately for farmers, this spelled essentially the euthanasia of the farming community, suicide for farmers. And I don't say this lightly. As a consequence of money in agriculture, since 1991, when India started liberalizing the economy and particularly the farm sector, since 1991, 350,000 Indian farmers have committed suicide. And they've committed suicide largely by drinking pesticide and so on. The very product, pesticide, which was basically bankrupting them because they had to borrow to buy pesticide and so on. When I say suicide of the farming community, I don't just mean it metaphorically. This is a literal problem. So from November 26th, left-wing farmers mass organizations, non-left-wing mass organizations and so on, gathered with the trade unions for the world's biggest general strike on the 26th of November. 250 million workers went on strike. Wow. In India. From that day, the farmers continued an agitation which goes on till today. I mean, I call this the farmers' revolt. It started on the 26th of November. They gathered around Delhi. They've been doing this all around India, but they basically surrounded Delhi with their tractors. You know, farmers, the farmers have their stuff. I mean, an agrarian revolt is dangerous because these guys have implements, scythes. You know, if you look at the communist symbol, it's a hammer and a sickle. I mean, what's more scary than a farmer with a sickle? These guys know it. And on 26th of January, which is India's Republic Day, when our constitution went into effect, farmers entered the city of Delhi. The government has been cracking down violently, calling them terrorists, calling them anti-national, arresting people, and recently going out there and setting the enforcement directorate against one of the main media houses that, you know, last month got 40 million views, called newsclick.in. For 113 hours, the government raided the homes of the journalists and so on, trying to shut them down, delegitimize them. But the farmers haven't stopped, and they're refusing to stop because they will not back down. For them, it's an existential struggle.
Also, there was no debate about this, right? It was pushed through without any debate in the Houses of Parliament.
This is very true. You see, if you believe in a democracy, you believe that even if there's 10 members of Parliament who are in the opposition, you've got to give them a chance to speak in Parliament. It should enter the record, you know. Their objections should be recorded, not just for the sake of parliamentarianism, you know, the rules of Parliament, but also it's a good thing for people to listen to contrary views. It's just healthy for a country. So they did, by voice vote, they rammed through these bills. And that's very disturbing.
I mean, the thing that I'm struck by is we did an episode of United States of America about American farms, and everything you said is the same here with independent and family farms, that they, you can't operate a family farm or an independent farm without a loan from the government, and the way in which those loans are given out, even it's not good for white farmers and certainly not good for farmers of color and black farmers. So it's the same thing you're saying. It's so when I first heard about this story, when I looked into it a little bit, it's like, oh, it's this, we're talking about the same struggles, very similar struggles.
This is a global problem, which is why in Brazil, farmers on the 26th of January lit a candle for Indian farmers, you know, because they know they're going through the same thing. In the 1980s, my colleague P. Sainath had been writing about farm crises, you know, from then. Once India liberalized their agricultural sector in 1991, Sainath began doing a series of stories in India about the farm crisis. And at the time, I was in Iowa. I came to Iowa and I wrote two stories about farm suicides in Iowa. And I remember writing the stories and then telling Sainath, you know, this is not just happening in India where we're seeing a spate of suicides. The United States has seen a number of farm suicides, and it's not just like this. It's also in the methamphetamine epidemic that has struck American rural areas, where farmers have gone to become meth producers rather than growing food, because you can make money in that. And meth labs explode, people get sick, people become meth addicts. It's a form of slow suicide. Agriculture cannot survive in a profit system. You'll start producing cash crops, you'll stop producing food. Mm. You know, we need to produce healthy food close to where people live. That's the system I want to live in. And that system is simply not profitable.
To understand the farmers' protests, especially in this country, I think there needs to be some understanding of the right-wing government. Can you explain how this government has functioned historically, especially in terms of inciting religious hatred, as well as what they're doing currently in the interests of the rich, aside from the farmers' bill? Like, clearly, there's a larger agenda.
You know, Modi, Mr. Narendra Modi of India, is not unlike, let's say, Donald Trump of the United States or Jair Bolsonaro of Brazil. There's a sort of fraternity here. And what we see with these political movements, Modi is a good example, is that they have taken advantage of the fact that the extreme center, the liberals, have basically collapsed. You know, the liberals have no answer to the problems of capitalism that capitalism has generated. Great inequality. The liberals have no solution. And in India, the Congress Party was part of the problem. The Congress Party drove an agenda which pushed for further integration into the world economy and basically mocked people for their problems. You know, so here I am, I can't find a job. Now I have to find the money for healthcare, to find the money for car insurance, find the money for this. I just can't take it anymore. And then comes the extreme right and says, blame the Muslims. Blame Mexicans, blame the Chinese, blame the blacks. And then I say, yes, exactly. Blame the Muslims. And this is actually, it's the liberals who create the dry firewood. And it's these nutcases that strike the match and throw it on the fire. Modi was both the person who helped prepare the firewood out there with a, you know, kind of practice pogrom in Gujarat in 2002, where, you know, 3,000 Muslims were killed in a very short period of time. Modi was the chief minister and so on. They prepared the kindling, as it were, prepared this so-called Hindu constituency. There's no Hindu constituency. Hindu is a fabrication. It doesn't exist. There are so many different communities in India. They were able to consolidate this into a political constituency. In many ways, it's the same as white. You know, I mean, what the hell is white? What's a white vote? You know, it's not, what the hell is that? No, they create a political, it's, you're politically white. That's what Trump rode on. He rode on a constituency which you should call politically white, politically Hindu. So Modi very cleverly came to power saying, blame everybody and don't look here, which is at capitalism. Don't look here, which is at my crony, Adani, Gautam Adani and so on. Don't look there. Look at these Muslims. If they behave like proper Indians, we'll advance. So they passed a series of bills recently, which basically a tantamount to removing citizenship from Muslims. And behind that hard right agenda against Muslims, they just push all this so-called labor market liberalization, all these reforms, you know, which are not reforms. I hate that they use the word reform for this. You know, it's like Trump is yelling and screaming, build the wall, build this, build that. And what is he doing here? Tax cuts for the wealthy, less regulation. These guys are all of a piece. They are actually dangerous people because they are not serious about the problems of the world. They are not serious about it. They are serious about power and they are able to shore up and advantage these crony capitalists at a time of great problems for the planet, when human beings need to come together to find solutions collectively.
Even predating this particular BJP government, there has been a degree of monitoring media and censorship. But this particular government has kind of doubled down on that, especially with political speech. Can you tell us what they've done to inhibit political activity through censorship during these farmers' protests?
Governments of this kind hate sunshine. You know, there's one thing when people protest, that can be, they can be corralled, they can be taken care of. They are dangerous for protesting, but for governments, it's equally dangerous that somebody reports on it. This government particularly understands very well the peril of allowing for a fully free press. So there are many ways in which press freedom is constrained. And the Indian government has done this in both ways. One, there is media consolidation. So there are some pretty hideous media houses that dominate the landscape. And these highly funded media entities, funded by big capital, took the lead in this, in narrowing and suffocating public speech. You know, this is a broad suffocation that happened over the years, where people who had differences of opinion were yelled down. They were called secessionists, terrorists, anti-national. Those were the terms. And they became normal terms. So that in public discussion, people would use phrases like, he's an anti-national. That's a very dangerous way to look at dissent, first in that period. The BJP has come in and has actually just ridden on this. They haven't pioneered anything. They just take the term anti-national and run with it. And as media consolidates, sensitive, good, left kind of reporters are just fired. We've seen a range of this happening. And this is the normal course of capitalism. As you know, buy up an entity, you fire all the left reporters. And then you have more people, as my colleague Sainath says, more people covering the Bombay Fashion Week than covering agriculture. And suddenly the newspapers of India look more and more like elite urban newspapers. They just don't cover Indian issues. By Indian issues, I mean issues that apply to the majority of Indians. 700 million Indians live in deprivation. Where are the stories on the lack of running water, the lack of health, etc.? No, you'll have more stories on, you know, the latest car being produced or some gossip and so on. So that is actually the lack of press freedom, guys. I mean, you take the US media, you don't actually need to put journalists in jail. You just need to suffocate public discussion so that nobody's talking about the methamphetamine epidemic and everybody's talking about what did that movie star say? What are the Trump children doing now? I don't care what the Trump children are doing now. You know, it doesn't impact me. I do care, you know, how are small businesses struggling in this period after so many months and so on. So that's a form of curtailment of press freedom. We should not forget that. That's a normal course of what's happening. They have been arresting and going after journalists. And this attack at NewsClick, which I mentioned, is very significant because they use the Enforcement Directorate, which has sweeping powers, to come in and harass and intimidate this media house, accusing it of money laundering when there is absolutely no evidence. And in fact, people in the Enforcement Directorate seem to indicate that there's really nothing here. They're leaking malicious stories to the media, talking about, you know, entities that are unknown. And I mean, it's all malice. This arrest of Disha Ravi is a serious business because she's 21 years old. She's part of Greta Thunberg's movement. All she did was create a toolkit how to support the farmers. She's accused of being a Khalistani, namely somebody who wants secession from India, you know, the Sikh movement to secede from India. I mean, where is this even coming from? But it tars her. And I think that's the thing that Modi also knows, that there's a constituency to whom this whole fantasy of a great nation is very attractive. You can't just say, oh, he's a nutcase, you know, blah, blah. They are able to cultivate a constituency, and everything horrendous they do has a public behind it. And we have to come to terms with that.
More than half of the workforce in India is in agriculture, and this clearly has screwed with a lot of people and their livelihoods. So is there potentially a response via the polls? Could the BJP lose enough seats to no longer be in power? Is that what they've set up? Is that even possible?
The translation between movements and electoral politics it's like a huge hill to climb. You know, you can bring out a million people on the streets, but tomorrow you don't know where they will vote. Patron-client relations play a role, and the left doesn't know how to do that. So the BJP has cultivated a whole entanglement of relationships with people. That's why it's difficult sometimes to translate mass movement politics into elections. A lot of money involved there, you know, payouts and so on. But in this case, there is a serious threat to the BJP. The state of Uttar Pradesh is the largest state in India. It's in North India. It's governed now completely by the BJP. There's a real rascal who's the chief minister. The western belt of Uttar Pradesh is largely agriculturalist. During the early part of the protesters came from Haryana and Punjab. And in Punjab, which is the state from where I am, Punjab, there was a very disturbing thing for the BJP because their ally broke with them on this. So in Punjab, they are not going to have the kind of control they used to have. When the BJP government cracked down on the farmers, one of the main farmer leaders in Western UP, Mr. Tikayat, gave a big speech and said, let's go to Delhi. And they mobilized tens of thousands of farmers to get on the road in their tractors and drive down to Delhi. The moment Tikayat did this, it threatened the election calculation in Uttar Pradesh. So the government is aware that there are actually ways in which they can suffer. But the problem is, Mr. Modi was re-elected in 2019. The parliament term goes on for several years. So they'll start a war here. You know how it works. What does one do? You start a war. You know the Wag the Dog movie. Start a war, start a riot against Muslims here. You do this, do that, some mischief or the other. There's enough time for them to cultivate mischief, delegitimize the opposition, and hand out cash to people to buy them off. And that's what's dangerous about the democracies we live in.
How can we outside of India put pressure on the Indian government? What can the international community do to come together? You know, clearly we haven't done a good job yet. What can we do?
Come on, we know that the reaction to that tweet, when Rihanna tweeted what she tweeted, the reaction was incredible. By the way, in the farmers movement, in the encampments outside Delhi, there are massive posters of Rihanna.
Oh my God.
She is treated as like an enormous hero. There are at least six songs, Punjabi songs, sung in honor of Rihanna. I just want to let you know that one tweet has elevated her to a world symbol for them. Because she, from, I don't know where she lives, I think Rihanna, by the way, is from Barbados. Am I wrong?
I think that's right. Yes.
She's from Barbados. I mean, you know, this is the third world consciousness. This Bajan has put her hand out from wherever she lives, maybe in Los Angeles, and touched the farmers of India. Solidarity is without calculation. Mm. You know, putting pressure and all that, let's set that aside. The farmers actually don't need anybody to put pressure. They are doing it themselves. They are making history. They would probably say, put pressure on your own government to wake up and stop treating its own farmers in this way. You know, start your farmers movement here. But there is nothing, no substitute for solidarity. The more people that come out and say, we stand not... See, my opinion is the farmer struggle in India, it's about those three bills, but it's not about India. They have opened a frontline struggle of agriculture against capitalism. They are right now the first frontline of a global struggle, which will, I think, hopefully will pick up over the years. So we should not understand this as an Indian struggle. We got to see this as a global struggle. Articulate your solidarity with the farmers of India, but make sure it's not just about India. It's about the right to grow good things, the right to eat good things, the right not to be as sick as we are becoming. Because essentially, half the time, I'm not sure, guys, if we're eating food. I'm not sure. I mean, sometimes, in my opinion, the packaging looks more tasty than the processed food. Why even bother to buy the processed food? Just buy the plastic wrapping and lick it. You know, you show your love to the farmers by showing your love also to yourself.
Guru, it is... a big deal that you agreed to do this, and it means the world to me. And you know, obviously I came of age reading your work and being shaped by, and the biggest compliment I've ever received is you telling me that your kids like my stand-up. Like, that to me is there's something full circle about that makes me feel really good. And
before we end, I do want to say that I remember you as a college student, and I remember the conversation we had when you said to me that you wanted to be a comedian. I remember this, and I remember it because this is the kind of conversation that's most meaningful to me, because a generation was raised being told you got to be a professional, you got to be a doctor, an engineer, a this or a that. And from then, I've been in search of, where are the artists in this community? Where are the comedians? Where are the painters? Where are the people who just want to walk on the streets and make sure people are okay? You know, the homeless activists. Where are they? You can't have a community if everybody's a doctor.
Well, you helped make those people. Your work helped shape those people who are doing the work that you wanted to see. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's a joy. It's a joy.
Vijay Prashad is an Indian historian and journalist. He's executive director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research and co-host of the podcast Give the People What They Want.
His latest book is Washington Bullets, a history of the CIA, coups, and assassinations.
Next up, we talk to the twin brother comic duo, the Lucas Brothers. They co-wrote the new film about the assassination of Black Panther leader Fred Hampton, Judas and the Black Messiah.
The Black Panthers are the single greatest threat to our national security. Our counterintelligence program must prevent the rise of a Black Messiah.
You're looking at 18 months for the stolen car, 5 years for impersonating a federal officer, or you can go home.
What do you want?
Get close to Hampton.
The Black Panthers are forming a rainbow coalition of oppressed brothers and sisters of every color.
Neutralize him by any means necessary.
Judas and the Black Messiah is the new film about the assassination of Fred Hampton. It's directed by Shaka King and stars Lakeith Stanfield and Daniel Kaluuya, and was co-written and co-produced by our guests, the Lucas Brothers.
Fred Hampton was the revolutionary young leader of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party.
He was attracted to the Black Panther Party because of its 10-point program that combined black self-determination and Marxist economics.
Hampton helped broker a non-aggression pact between the city's most powerful street gangs. He helped organize free breakfast programs, a free medical center, and blood drives for the Cook County Hospital. And he worked to forge a class-conscious, multiracial alliance between the Panthers, the Young Lords, and the Young Patriots Organization.
In 1967, when he was just 19, the FBI identified Hampton as a radical threat, and they used an informer, a 17-year-old William O'Neill, to get close to him. In December of 1969, Fred Hampton, along with fellow Panther Mark Clark, was gunned down in his apartment by Chicago police with the support and cooperation of the FBI and its COINTELPRO program.
Keith and Kenny Lucas started talking about making a movie about Fred Hampton when they were still in college, before they were even comedians. It's been a long road, and it's a huge accomplishment.
Let's get Keith and Kenny in here to talk about it. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having us.
I've been hearing about this movie for a while because I'm friends with Rosa Clemente.
Oh, nice. She's awesome.
Yeah, she's awesome.
Yeah, she's been on our podcast a couple times, and she's like, you know, you have those people in your life who you're the ones who reach out and go, you're fucking up. Rose is one of those people for me. So every now and again. Or she'd be like, say it more like this. So she's been talking about this movie for a long time. But it wasn't until recently I realized that you two guys were involved. So it was just a pleasant surprise. You know, we all start doing comedy. We all have this idea of what it is to be a comedian. And then many of us end up in places where comedians don't tend to go. And it seems like this is one of those versions of that story.
It's crazy because it's like, right when we got into the industry, we were thinking about making this film. So it was like we entered stand up with ambitions to make this film. So it's weird because I don't see them as diametrically opposed. I see it like it's like a part of the same sort of process, essentially. You know, like, you know, I think comedians are very, very deep thinkers. And, you know, we have a way of looking at tragic events and spinning it into comedy, but we still look at the tragic events. You know what I mean? We don't shy away from the tragedy, especially as a, you know, comedians who are into politics, into history, into philosophy. You can't help but not look at these stories and think, is there a way we can get them to a larger platform? So I don't know. I feel like with Hampton's story, it's like when you hear it for the first time, it just overwhelms you. And I was always shocked that it just wasn't more widely known.
It's amazing to think about that this was in your head from the beginning, because that means you went through all sorts of terrible shows with four people in the audience. And in the back of your head, you're thinking, God, this is going to get us that Fred Hampton movie. I know that. Just a matter of time till people finally catch on.
That's hilarious.
When did you first hear the Fred Hampton story? Because I feel like he gets lost often in the narrative of the Black Panthers in the 60s. And maybe part of that is because he died so young. But like, when did you first hear it? Because it's heartbreaking. And every time I hear it, you know, and I have heard it, I'm like, why is there no movie about this?
When did you first hear it? We came across Hampton's story in college. It was 2004. It was our sophomore year, and we were taking this African-American studies course with great professor, Professor Fisher. And we had this section on, so it basically covered African-American history post-Reconstruction up until like the early 1970s, late 1960s. And so right around like the 67 section, we got into Hampton and we were talking about a lot of shit. We're talking about the Chicago chapter, the Oakland chapter, New Haven chapter, you know, so it wasn't like this, like a singular focus on Hampton. But I remember being sort of shocked when I came across the fact that the FBI was involved with his assassination. And I was like, what? Like, because we looked so hard for evidence that the FBI was directly involved in the assassination of King. We're like, we know Hoover set that shit up, but we have no evidence. So it always comes off as conspiratorial. With Hampton, it's like, no, there's direct evidence that the FBI handler, Roy Mitchell, worked with the Chicago Police Department to execute this raid. And I'm like, if we have an example there, that could easily provide circumstantial evidence for a case against the FBI with King. So I was always just like blown away by that. And it just sort of stayed in my mind, like, why aren't we talking about it? I mean, I know why we aren't talking about it, but I'm like, I would love for us to have a more honest conversation about COINTELPRO.
You speak just like a guy who dropped out the last week of law school. Circumstantial evidence and to build a case.
Yeah, about,
you know, I gotta use my legal education for something.
Yeah, about that. Why didn't you just, you had a week left. I mean, you could have just done the week.
Look, we wanted to make this Fred Hampton movie, man. Every second counts.
Like, the loans, you already had the debt. You might as well finish to get the little, that, I mean, I will tell you, as someone with a master's from the London School of Economics, that helps with NPR interviews. I'll tell you, if you wanted into the public radio world, that JD would have helped.
See, I wasn't thinking that much in advance. I thought it would make us seem more like rebels if we walked away from the legal education. You know, we thumbed our nose to the system. I was also stoned on drugs, so I don't know which one would have had more of an influence, but it was one of those things.
Also, with the Fred Hampton story, like, people keep talking about this generation of young people and teenagers that are going to change the world, mm-hmm. and how this is this groundbreaking time. Fred Hampton was 21 when he was killed.
Right.
I mean, that means he had been organizing in his teens. And the idea that the head of the FBI wanted to kill essentially a kid is like stunning.
I
mean,
a creepy 70-year-old white man wanted to kill a 20-year-old black kid. I mean,
maybe it's not that stunning then.
I mean, at the root of it, it's so like, this is it's kind of crazy. Like, this old man was so terrified of this young kid. It's just like the fact that that man was able to obtain that amount of power, but was still afraid of a kid is an American story.
Yeah.
And I think you can't really remind people enough that he was 21, because when you see clips of the actual Fred Hampton, he seems like a 40-year-old man. Like, he just like, and his facility with words is something that, it's not an age attached to it, but I wish I had that kind of facility with words.
Absolutely. Still going
through my words right now.
Oh my
and
God.
To think that he was 21.
And the, the breadth of his knowledge, I mean, the depth of his knowledge was, you know, he had such a robust knowledge on Marxism and socialism, and his critiques of capitalism were well beyond his years. I mean,
you know,
he just didn't seem like he was 21.
Another thing that blew my mind is his like analysis of foreign policy at 21. Like he would talk about, you know, different like revolutionary movements across the globe with like ease, like a statesman. And I was like, how is he doing this at 21? It made no sense to me.
The fact the movie's called Judas and the Black Messiah, the fact you spent so much time not only with Fred Hampton, whose story is already remarkable, but also with William O'Neill, who served as an FBI informant, who, by the way, when it's revealed at the end of the film that he was 17, I don't know if it's real or I read he was, but he was 17 when this happened. Like, even without that information, you see the story of someone who's absolutely a victim of all this as well. Like, he's thrown in. Why did you all decide to not just focus on Fred Hampton? How come you chose to make Bill O'Neill such a big part of this story?
You know, we were doing a ton of research in the early like 2010s, just like trying to figure out, okay, what angle can we take to tell this story? What would be the most interesting way to tell this story cinematically? And we were just trying to, we're struggling to sort of condense Hampton's story into the traditional biopic. And we were like, COINTELPRO plays such an integral role in the story of Hampton that once we found out about William O'Neill, we were like, maybe that's the angle we can take, because we had stumbled upon this transcript of the Eyes on a Prize interview. We hadn't seen the actual video. We just saw the transcript. And it read like a crime thriller, you know what I mean? He talks about how he got recruited into the FBI or coerced into the FBI. He talks about his time frame within the Panthers, and he talks about how Fred Hampton was able to build a coalition of different groups. So he kind of just breaks it down in a three-act structure, and we were just like, yeah, this could be a good skeleton for a film.
And I think another reason was we wanted to sort of humanize COINTELPRO in a sense, right? Like, you can tell a story about the system of ideas and it feels sort of like academic almost, or you humanize it through a character, and you actually feel what it was like to participate in such an egregious activity.
I think humanize is the wrong word. I think you meant personalize.
Personalize. Fuck William O'Neill ultimately, but it's like, you know, we want to personalize COINTELPRO.
It's interesting you say that, because last night, in addition to watching the movie, now there's a YouTube channel called Real Black, where this guy puts up a lot of old school black content, and there's a half hour chunk of Eyes on the Prize 2 that has that part that is just the part of his interview,
right.
And it is super creepy to see that this guy
so creepy
is still like sort of at that point was trying to figure out a way to, how do I say I was involved in the murder of Fred Hampton in a way that doesn't make people mad.
He's still
how do I say this in a way that make people go, good for you? And you can see him trying to like walk this fine line.
Right.
And in many ways, I feel like nobody's better at walking that fine line than Lakeith Stanfield. All he has to do is look far off into the distance, and you go, he's tortured.
Right,
you know, I don't know him personally, but he does a really great job of playing that. Like, I like you, but you're a piece of shit.
He doesn't have the real William O'Neill
didn't have the I like you part though.
Right. What was crazy is like we didn't get the full interview until like we were really close to production, and Shaka found the actual full length interview. We saw clips of it, but we never saw the full length one. And watching the full length one, I mean, it's just like, it's horrifying. It's like, it's really, really creepy that he truly, I think, I don't know what he believed, but at least from what he said, he seems like he really believed that he did a good thing. And
right.
Obviously he was tortured inside, but like, it was just
and
stunning.
He was 17 when he got involved in it. Like, you
right.
know.
Right, right, right.
But then he, you know, after a while, he committed himself to being an FBI informant, and maybe he just couldn't get out. I don't know, but yeah, he made some questionable choices that he ultimately paid the ultimate price for.
As stand-up comics, going into film, writing a film that is, you know, this isn't a stoner comedy. It's the biopic of Fred Hampton. Like,
well,
this is
we originally pitched it as a stoner comedy, and it was getting no traction. I was like, come on, this would be a great buddy
cop. Will Ferrell will play Bill O'Neill.
Seth Rogen will play. But like, you know, how does one get from, you know, being in the position of being stand-up comics and having this idea for a film about a very serious subject matter, and, you know, getting it made, getting it to Shaka King? I'm also saying this because I got a ton of colonialism film ideas I've been sitting on for quite some time. But how did that happen?
Yeah, it was a lot of failure. It was
you're
a
twinning
lot of,
yourselves,
like,
guys.
We're working on some jokes. But I think we took a lot of failure. We took a lot of L's. Like, we had no idea what we were doing in the beginning. Like, we went out to California, LA, and we're like, we're going to pitch this story. We're going to sell it. We're going to write the script. Everything's going to be like kumbaya. And it just wasn't happening. Like, it was like, we don't think that this is developed enough, or we don't think that you guys, like, I don't know if they saw us as like legitimate film people when we walked into the room to pitch it.
There's
like
certainly an institutional bias against stand-up comedians trying to pursue drama.
Right. It's weird. It's like they just have this sort of notion that you're not capable of doing it. So you're like, all right, you got to work against that as a comedian, and which is crazy because I'm like, comedians are the smartest people I know. Like, we can do whatever we want. So I'm like, all right, fuck that. So we were like, if we hook up with a filmmaker, have him sort of translate our ideas in the visual language, it'll better our package.
It also helps that Shaka is just an immensely talented filmmaker. He just he basically saw the whole movie right there, and then he was able to just like, and then, you know, we were fortunate enough to actually work with another screenwriter by the name of Will Burson, who had already written his own script about Fred Hampton, and it was brilliant. Right. And so we were just like, let's just synthesize the two, you know, take our story idea and take Will's script and just morph it into the script that we finally got. And Will and Shaka went off and wrote that, but it was like being able to connect with people in the comedy world to make this like really, really dramatic film, I think it was all just like serendipitous.
We all had like this, we want to prove that as comedians, we can do this shit. Like, we want to prove that we can make a dope dramatic crime thriller, and it stand the test of time. I think we all had that sort of that sort of idea behind us.
I also like the Jermaine Fowler cameo at the end, where his only purpose is to get killed at the end of the movie. And then I'm like, oh, those are his friends. His friends did that to him, right? Yeah.
And Jermaine always looks like he's having a good time. So even though he knew that was coming, he was like...
And what's crazy is that, like, Jermaine was actually, he knew Will Burson. He knew that we were working with Shaka on our story. So he actually made the connection.
Wow.
He connected us to Will. And everything would just happen. So, like, it was meant to be this way. Because
you could have given him a bigger part then. Jeez. Like,
he was filming Coming to America.
Oh, that's right.
We couldn't get him for too much.
This was also challenging, I imagine, because you're working... You know, Fred Hampton didn't die 100,000 years ago.
So his son is here.
His fiance is there, is around. And there's people who remember it very vividly who are still around and who are in and around the production. And I would assume, no matter how well you do it, there's still going to be like some tension there. Some natural tension.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, we were on set and. You know, it was a bunch of Panthers on set and they were incredibly protective of Hampton's legacy, which makes total sense. I mean, it's Fred Hampton. You don't want to butcher his story. But, you know, there were moments of tension on set where it was just like, how are we going to best portray Hampton? How much time are we going to give Hampton compared to William O'Neill? It was just like they were healthy discussions. You know, it wasn't like. It wasn't anything that was unreasonable. It was like I totally understood the dynamics at play. And I think Shaka did a great job of just, you know, being able to diffuse any of the tension because he's so like unhurried and he's so kind of laid back that like he comes from a comedy background. So I think he can see the humor in it all. And he was able to like just diffuse a lot of the tension. And we had a lot of other producers making sure, like, you know, they took care of any of the concerns that the Panthers had. So while there was tension, it was just it was healthy. I think it was healthy for the process, and I think that it made the product a lot better.
There's like this balance between you know, maintaining the authenticity of what the Panthers stood for versus, you know, making a good film. Like these are competing interests. You know what I mean? Because one is art. Inherently artistic, while the other is more about the preservation of someone's historical legacy. So you have to like figure out, well, what's that fine line? Like, what sacrifices do you make for the art versus making sure you preserve his legacy? And I think we did a pretty good job of that.
From the people who you know, who love Fred Hampton and love and know his story and understand the tragedy of it all, I've seen a lot of positive feedback, which has been great. It's just like people just like I grew up listening to Fred Hampton and. I think you guys, I think the whole team did a great job in like preserving his legacy and presenting him in a way that he should be presented.
In another interview, I read that you felt the film changed your life and how you view the world. And you talk about this concept of happy nihilism.
Early in our act, I mean, it was important for us to like convey this sense of like, we're nihilistic, but we're happy about it. We're stoners, like. And when you're first concocting your act, you're not like thinking about like the psychological implications of what you're saying. You're just trying to get funny and get people to like your act and get the audiences. So eventually you can be like Kevin Hart. That's the goal, right?
Yes, 100%.
So that was the idea. We were these happy nihilists. We were these stoners. It was who we were. And then, you know, a lot of shit started happening. You know, Kevin died.
Hold up. Wait a minute.
Kevin Barnett was a beloved stand-up comic and a writer for shows including Broad City, The Carmichael Show, and The Eric Andre Show. He was head writer and co-star of the sketch comedy show Friends of the People, where he worked alongside the Lucas Brothers. He also wrote for Keith and Kenny's cartoon series, Lucas Brothers Moving Company.
Kevin Barnett died suddenly in 2019 at age 32 while on vacation in Mexico from complications caused by pancreatitis.
The Lucas Brothers hosted a tribute show for Kevin Barnett at the Bell House in Brooklyn with performances by comics including Hannibal Buress, Michael Che, and Alana Glazer.
You know, the drugs were getting out of control. Like, we were just starting to do shit. Like, it was just getting crazy. And then the Hampton shit started happening. So you're constantly watching Hampton. You're constantly listening to his speeches. You're talking to family members. You're seeing Kaluuya act his ass. So you're just, all this shit happening we're grieving the loss of our friend, like heavy. And I'm like, I don't want to drink anymore. And it's just like nihilism starts to become this sort of like, it feels like a weird sort of placeholder for true emotions. You know what I mean? It's like you're saying you're a nihilist because you don't really want to confront the shit that makes you sad. So I think like that shit just started to break down. And I was eventually like, look, I don't want to be nihilistic anymore. I want to live for something. Even if it's just like a PlayStation 5 or cryptocurrency, I want to live. I need to live for something. You know what I mean? So I think that's what I meant.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you can't listen to Fred Hampton and I mean, I guess you can't. I mean, William Winnow listened to Fred Hampton and still maintained his ego. But for me, it's like you can't listen to Fred Hampton and know the William Winnow story and still be committed to like principles of egoism and things like nihilism. I just felt like we all serve a larger purpose. And I think Hampton was able to just crystallize a lot of it for me. His philosophy was so in tune to like serving the people and spreading love. And despite living in harsh conditions and with the state trying to kill him and actually killing him, like he still maintained a degree of optimism, which was, again, surprising to me after reading so much about him, how hopeful he was that things can get better. So it's like, you can't listen. It was hard for me to listen to his message and not feel moved in any way. And so I just moved away from nihilism completely.
Can we talk about Daniel Kaluuya a little bit? His portrayal of Fred is so embodied and the voice is so, like, that's got to be a hard voice to take on. And to me, I had a little bit of that, like, it's not even so much that he looks like him. It's sort of like Denzel as Malcolm X, but you're somehow channeling. There's a bigger thing happening here. Can you talk about what it was like to be around him and his process?
We were at the table read and, you know, he came in. This is our first time actually meeting him. And we weren't sure what to expect. You've been at table reads before where people kind of just phone it in just to get through it and move on with their lives. But he brought it. He brought that sort of that Fred Hampton spirit into the table read. And so we're all there and we're listening to him sort of perform the speeches and just like he really just like turned it completely on. And right after the table read was done, we were all just like, it was like a moment of silence because we were just like, what did we just witness? We just witnessed probably one of the greatest table read performances ever. And I was just like, this is remarkable. Like, if he brings that to the film, like, he's going to take the film to the next level, because that's the type of performance, which obviously, you know, Hampton was this powerful speaker and this great orator and this charismatic person. And the fact that he was able to nail it at the table read was, to me, just mind blowing.
Yeah, I was like, I'm not working hard as an actor. Like, if that's acting, then what I'm doing is like, it's not. It's not. It shouldn't count. It should be on the same level.
It's not on the same level.
I know.
Kamau said this actually before the interview. Like, his accent. I mean, this guy's proper British. Like, he's a British dude. So when you hear his actual voice and see what he does with the character, it just makes you feel bad. Like, this guy is so talented.
He's like a next level. It's like it's like Brando, man. It's like the power and the emotion that he conveys on screen, sometimes without even saying a word.
Yes.
Immensely powerful. And we were on set during the church scene. And, you know, we're on set and it was almost like we're at a fucking stand-up show because the crowd was just going crazy. And he just walks on stage and he just delivers this impassioned speech. And after the speech, people just started giving him a round of applause, like a standing ovation.
Wow.
I've never seen anything like this before, where it's like you felt like you were in the 60s watching Fred Hampton deliver a speech. For that moment, it just felt like Fred Hampton's spirit was there. So he's a very, very talented dude. And he really, really took up this challenge to portray Hampton to the best of his abilities. And I know some people were giving him some slack because, you know, he's British and he's a little bit older, but I'm like, He really embodied the spirit of Hampton. I can't see anyone else doing it. He really took it to the next level.
Well, that's the challenge with things like this, right? Like, there's not going to be like 9 Fred Hampton biopics because hashtag racism. You know what I mean? Like, they're gonna, like, there may be 9 other Johnny Cash biopics eventually. But
there's 2 you know. On the long distance runner Steve Prefontaine. That came out at the same time, in fact.
I recall that.
No way. That's so crazy.
There's competing Snow White reboots. That's probably where some of the tension comes from, or from the community. It's not like we can't wait for the next one, so we have to nail it this time.
Exactly. Right. I don't think people understand how difficult it is to make these kinds of movies. I mean, I see people saying, man, they should have done it like this. I'm like, you don't understand. Like, it took us 10 years, and even more if you count the fact that he's been gone for 50 years. So it's like, there were a lot of people trying to get this story made, and you have forces that you have to go up against, and you have to really, really like figure out not only the best way to tell a story, but what's the way to tell a story that's going to give you a chance to actually make the film.
Can you guys talk a little bit about the philosophy of Fred Hampton, what you learned about it, what you understood better through the process of making the film? And just for people who haven't seen the film and haven't heard of Fred Hampton, talk about why he was such a charismatic figure and what he was trying to tell
right.
us.
Right. So, I mean, Hampton was a committed Marxist. He was a revolutionary Marxist. He was well-versed in all of the, you know, the proper, you know, Hegel. He was familiar with Hegel. He was familiar with Mao. He quoted Che. I mean, he was a committed Marxist revolutionary.
Hold up. Wait a minute.
We know what Marxism isn't. It's not what Newsmax or Tom Cotton say it is. It's not the Squad. It's not Medicare for All. It's not the 1619 Project.
But what is it? Fortunately, we have a bona fide Marxist scholar on this episode, so we asked him.
Marxism isn't a thing by itself. Marxism is a critique of capitalism. I mean, capitalism is not a humanitarian system. Capitalists are motivated by profit. So what a Marxist does is, a Marxist says there's something wrong with the system. Because, you see, we are all working to produce things. Everybody works to produce. Our production of wealth in society is social. But only a few people accumulate the gains that we all socially produce. That's wrong. And a Marxist says that must be changed. Social wealth should be socially accumulated, not privately accumulated.
What's Marxism? What Vijay said.
And no matter what, I'm sure there's another Marxist somewhere hearing his definition going, that's not Marxism.
I happened to dabble in Marxism when I was in college. And so I think that was part of my attraction to Hampton. When I first came across this story, I was like, I'm a young guy committed to Marxism. He's a young guy committed to Marxism. You know,
and that's where, the comparison
And
stopped.
That's where the comparison What I should say is I did join the Marxist party because it was a very attractive girl. and she became a Marxist, and I was like, oh, maybe I could, you know. She dated and got married to a Russian guy who was not a Marxist. Very ironic. But
I can't wait for that movie that you guys make.
No, I was attracted to the fact that he was a Marxist. And so, like, and he was a Black dude growing up in tough situation in Chicago. And I loved that about him. And as we went into this deep dive, understanding him as a character and as a person, you just learned that Marxism stemmed from love. Like, he truly, genuinely loved the people. He truly, genuinely loved seeing people elevate beyond their situation and their circumstances. Like, and it's like, that's the type of love that's hard to understand. It's like, it's not romantic love. You know what I mean? It's not, you know, loving your wife or your partner. It's not loving your brother. It's not even loving, it's not loving your mom. It's loving this sort of like, sort of vague concept of people. And you know what I mean? And it's giving your life to them. It's like, it's so just like, hard to even understand how he arrived at that point so early.
Martin Luther King Jr., I think, would be 91, 92. Right. Malcolm X would still be less than 100 years old. Fred mm-hmm. Hampton clearly would be like, what, 72, 73, somewhere yeah, like that.
Bernie's age.
What if he had been allowed to live? Because he did so much in a short period of time. And I love the fact that the film constantly focuses on the breakfast program.
Right.
Yeah. Like, there's just a constant return to like, and we're still, all this is happening, Black kids are still getting fed.
Right.
And mm-hmm. I think it's important to, you know, the thing that people, a lot of people don't know, the Black Panthers, that was the start of it. Was protecting our community and feeding right. people, and feeding right. our kids breakfast. Right. And I think that, like, who knows what that turns into, but we don't know because America. And I think you don't sit there and go, man, this sounds like a long time ago. You don't sit there.
Yeah.
You
know, yeah.
You say, it sounds like today, while it's said a long time ago. But I think that that's the thing I think is most powerful about the film is that what if?
That's what makes it so tragic. It was like Hampton was only 21, and as you said, he did so much at a young age, and you can't help but think, man, what would he have become if mm-hmm. he wasn't murdered by the state? I mean, he was such a powerful leader, and you know, he could have done anything, really. I mean, he had the gifts to do anything. Senator, he could have run for president. He had so much charisma, and he had so many great ideas on ways to, you know, fix in this country. That's why it's so tragic. I mean, I spoke about Bernie, and I'm like, you know, they're from the same generation. Bernie mm-hmm. was out in Chicago. I mean, he's from Brooklyn, obviously, but he went to school in Chicago, so I'm sure he's familiar with the story. And it's like, yeah, could you imagine those two guys just like in the Senate trying to push for different types of policies that I think can help Americans? It's just like we lost a powerful voice when we lost Hampton, and it's crazy that the state was willing to sacrifice such a great person just because of their racism, essentially.
Think about the events of January 6th and the insurrection, and the fact that so openly these people were able to...
Why are you still thinking about that? That was like over
10,000 years ago.
Taylor Swift is reissuing her album. I mean, we're Taylor Swift time, you know what I mean?
But like thinking about the fact that they talk as if like they didn't know, like the authorities didn't know, even though this was it was on the internet and they discussed it, and you know, and meanwhile, you know, I've watching, you know, I was struck by that while watching the film last night. Just every single move the Black Panthers made in multiple cities, the FBI knew. The number of plants they had, the number of people that were wired. Meanwhile, these people are openly writing shit on the internet.
I know. Like, this is before Twitter. And the FBI was like, did they have better technology in the 60s?
Right. Like, we tap ourselves now. We don't even need people to tap us. And the fact that, like, you know, that was allowed to happen, and you hear about the, you know, all the things the Black Panthers did. The Black Panthers had plans, man.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that maybe the government didn't like some of the plans. But when we're talking about health care and feeding people, these white people charging into the cup, they have no plans.
No plans.
It's just chaos.
Yep.
So it's so infuriating. How, and maybe this is a bigger question, how do you take all that anger and not let it completely consume you? Because I just watching it yesterday, I'm just furious again about how young he was, about how much they did to destroy a movement that was accomplishing so many things. It's not like, well, we got a better free lunch program. No, you don't. You did, like, the government doesn't give a shit. How did you turn that energy into this?
I mean, I think weed is probably the only thing that keeps me sane. No, I mean, it's like, I think you just have to really want to see it through, because you have to recognize that the message and who it can impact is much larger than yourself. Like, it's like, this is a movement. This is a moment in time that's going to be remembered. And I feel like the art we make has to represent that as well. And I felt like I think making it a duty helped, not seeing it as something that's going to help me. Like, seeing it as something that's just like going to help a movement just made it so much easier.
Right. It's just like, again, once you read Fred's message of having a love for the people and his willingness to commit himself to a larger purpose, that's kind of how I saw this film. It's like, it wasn't about me anymore, and it wasn't about whatever I can gain from it. It was about what can we do to make sure we get this story made and put it in the best position to influence a generation of people. You want to make sure you do right by Fred. I mean, it's like, and I saw it on set too, just seeing all these different artists, you know, from hair and makeup to costume to the DP to everyone involved in this film sort of just took it upon themselves to make sure they tell Fred's story to the best of their abilities. I mean, you could feel his spirit sort of permeate throughout the set. I'd never seen anything like this before, where it just felt like almost like a religious experience, where you're just like, it wasn't about the ego anymore. It was about doing what's best for Fred and the Hampton family. And that played a role in the conception of the idea all the way to promoting the film. I mean, he had a deep impact on a lot of folks involved in the film.
So comedy's over now?
Well, yeah, the pandemic took care of that. Yeah, are you guys once this pandemic's over, are you guys doing sets now? Are you going back? Are you still standing up comics?
I gotta get back on stage.
I desperately want to get back on stage. I miss it. We haven't been able to get up as much, obviously, because of this fucking pandemic, but it's nothing like hearing laughs and just being with the people and just like telling a bad joke and people looking at you like, why would you tell such a bad joke? It's like, I don't know. I love the stage, man. I love it.
You're in a weird position now, you two, because now you're sort of like in the important black folks category. So does that, are you still going to be able to do the, like, you know, some of the less important black jokes?
No, man, fuck that, man.
Yeah, I'm committed to being the truest version of myself. I mean, if people want to get on board, then by all means, but being who we are, it got us this far, so I'm not going to change.
I just can't wait for that credit when it's time to go back on stage and they have to say, co-writers of Judas and the Black Messiah. Like, what? Stand-up? What? This is going to be a laugh fest. Man.
Right. Contradictions.
Well, thank you to you two for doing the podcast. Thank you for being on the show. We appreciate
of course.
It.
Thank you for making
thank
that
you for
movie,
making this
man.
Movie.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Thank you. Thank you guys for having us. You guys have been huge influences on us comedically. And a great opportunity to shoot the shit, man. Thank you.
And I'll get back to you about my Gandhi and Nehru movie. The Lucas Brothers co-wrote and co-produced Judas and the Black Messiah, the new movie about the assassination of Black Panthers leader Fred Hampton.
Judas and the Black Messiah is now in theaters, but better than that, it's streaming on HBO Max. If you want to dig deeper into the story of Fred Hampton, I got a couple things to suggest. First of all, subscribe to the movie's companion podcast, same name as the film, Judas and the Black Messiah, and also the YouTube channel Real Black. That's R-E-E-L-B-L-A-C-K. There is a 30-minute clip of the Eyes on the Prize episode that features the story of Fred Hampton.
Also, you can see Kenny and Keith's comedy special On Drugs. That's the name of the special. You can watch it any way you'd like. It's on Netflix.
They will also star opposite Laurel Howery and Jermaine Fowler's forthcoming comedy, The Come Up. Jermaine Fowler's having a great year. That's it for this week. Thanks to Vijay Prashad and to Kenny and Keith Lucas, the Lucas Brothers.
We always want to hear what you think about the conversations we're having on Politically Reactive.
Leave us a voicemail at 917-477-6525.
That's 917-477-6525.
And keep your comments and questions coming on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram with the hashtag Politically Reactive.
And rate and review the show wherever you get your podcasts. It does spread the word and help people discover the show. Not that we need to be discovered. You know, if you want to hear the show, hear the show. But you don't need to. Please hear the show.
Check out farmersprotest.carrd.co. Farmersprotest.carrd.co.
You can find Kamau and I on all the various platforms, except you're not on TikTok, right?
I have an account, but I haven't ticked the talk yet.
But you can find us on the internet, watch our Netflix specials, and again, sign our email list on our web pages, because I swear, one day we're going to go on tour again, and you're going to want to be there, and that's one way you can find out.
Politically Reactive is a production of Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network. Executive producers are Maria Zuckerman and Christy Gressman.
And the Honorable W. Kamau Bell.
And my son, Hari Kondabolu.
I'll take that as a compliment. The show is produced by Matt Martin, Malachi Seeger, Sakir, and Kelly Rafferty. Will Stanton engineers and mixes the show.
And thanks, as always, to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show. Thanks for listening to Politically Reactive.
I'm a great aficionado of Bruce Lee.
Oh.
And many years ago, I wrote a book called Everybody Was Kung Fu Fighting. yes. Actually, I have written a book with that title. So.
Oh, I'm going to check that out. As I call myself, I'm the leading Bruce Lee expert in the non-Asian category.
That's fair. I think that's allowed. I should say that the book is actually, it's cheating because the book is about, it's a long history of Afro-Asian connections.
Oh, really?
And the last chapter is on the 1960s. the connections between the Panthers, the Red Guards, the Iroquois, the Young Lords, the, you know, those groups. And Bruce Lee is this cultural icon because his movies are anti-Vietnam War movies. And they're not seen like that. I mean, why else is he fighting against Chuck Norris in the Colosseum? You know, I mean, what is that? Like, this is a great symbol of West, you know, that's Western civilization. And Chuck Norris was pretty game to get just beaten by him every time.
I love that Chuck Norris's greatest work is getting beaten by Bruce Lee.
It is.
Yeah, I mean, he's your straight white man, you know. he's the straight white man to Bruce Lee. And I mean, in fact, I think it's one of the films, I've forgotten, where Bruce Lee is in Southeast Asia or somewhere, we don't know. And he's at a dojo and it gets attacked. And I mean, they're all wearing clothes that look like the uniform of the Viet Cong.
Wow. And,
you know, it's amazing. It's the black pajamas and Bruce Lee is just, he's exquisite.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.